House Committee on Environment and Energy, April 6, 1987, Hearing Room E. Public Hearing and Possible Work Session, House Bill 3097. Work Session, House Bill 2026. Public Hearing and Possible Work Session, House Bill 3313, 3314, 3315. Public Hearing, House Bill 2663. Public Hearing, House Bill 3162.
I'll call the meeting of the House Environment and Energy Committee to order. The clerk will note that Representative Soa, Representative Peterson, Representative Ekus, Representative Berea will be along shortly. The House Democrats had a late caucus, so I think they're still at lunch. We have a number of items on the agenda today. Now, let me give you an indication of the order. We will take these. We will first do House Bill 3097 relating to destination resorts. That's a public hearing, and then we will go into a public hearing on House Bills 2663 relating to Lifeline Telephone Service and House Bill 3162 relating to the provision of telecommunication devices for the deaf. At this point, I will open the hearing on House Bill 3097 and ask Representative Agram to come forward. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My remarks will be very brief and intended only to introduce the folks who have come to testify on behalf of the bill. I would point out to you the genesis of this bill has been coming for quite some time and was brought to my attention by County Commissioner Roger Hamilton, who will provide testimony. In bringing the concept to me and asking for introduction, I realized that we were into a very sensitive subject, and I wanted to be certain that the details were adequately worked out and soundly based. Initial work was done on the bill by Roy Hubert, who will also testify, who is our Klamath County planner, who then met with an association of county planners, 12 or 13 or 14 of them, who worked on the language together. And they will be represented today by Mr. Russ Nebon, who is the Marion County planner, and he's handy. And they can describe the process and the issues as they see them on a broad scale. This is not simply a Klamath County issue. It is one that has implications throughout the state as well. I simply want to point out to you that we see this as a part of a process, a natural process that takes place over time when legislation is put in place and it exists for a while, and then people begin to see some places where it is working well and some places where it needs some help. This is one of those places where we think some tuning up is necessary. We see it as an economic development issue, and particularly from my part of the country, and we think in other places as well. And we trust that you will give it your full attention. After the folks who have come who will provide their testimony, and some of them have to leave immediately and head home, I'll of course be here and be very willing to work with you and any other questions that you may have or further follow-up information that's needed in order to work this bill properly. I commend it to your attention, and hopefully you'll give it a favorable response.
Bernie, before you call your people, let me ask Senator Yee to come forward. I think she wants to speak on this bill, too, and then we'll go with your people.
Good.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm State Senator Mei Yee from District 19, and I'm here to support the Destination Resort Bill. I'm very much in favor of supporting tourism and creating destination resort to attract vacationers. I also see this as an economic development measure, taking advantage of our beautiful natural resources and creating jobs for our people. I would like to take this opportunity to make two amendments on page 2, line 19, sub 3. It says at least $2 million in 1984 dollars shall be spent on improvements. And I would like to see it lower to $1 million. There are small cities, especially in my district, in Sweet Home, we have Foster Lake, and they could build destination resort there. But with a smaller minimum investment, they can get started sooner. And also on page 2, line 44, 38 air miles, I would like to see you amend it to 30 road miles, because Foster Lake near Sweet Home will not qualify if it's 30 air miles. Maybe you can change it to 30 road miles. They would be qualified, and they have beautiful lake out there where vacationers will be delighted to stop, take vacation, and do their sports and recreation there. And that's all I wish to propose, and would appreciate your favorable consideration. And I have a statement here.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What I'm going to try to do on this measure, since we have a number of people that want to testify, as we get into it, I'd ask everybody if try to keep it within a time limit, and if you come forward to give testimony for this bill or against the bill, if your points have already been stated, let's see if we can't control the time. Please. Welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Cease, members of the committee. I'm Roger Hamilton, representing the Klamath County Board of Commissioners. The Oregon comeback will not be achieved in rural areas if we cannot encourage the non-extractive use of our wealth of natural amenities to destination resort siting. Tourism and outdoor recreation may well perform as magnets to attract potential employers and investors, as the governor has suggested in his regional economic strategy discussions. But we can't accomplish this goal without an effective and creative visitor resort siting process. The Goal 8 definition of destination resorts refers to a self-contained development providing visitor-oriented accommodations and developed recreational facilities in a setting with high natural amenities. The current state rules are too inflexible to allow for such sightings in most of our state. In 1984, during Klamath County's acknowledgement process, only one needs exception was approved. The present exceptions process has been has been patched time and time again since 1973, and has left us with a convoluted, complex, and nearly impossible set of criteria to understand or meet. Until the state exceptions process is completely rewritten, we will see more and more bills such as this one being introduced. We propose language that would change the recreational standards to allow a destination resort to be sited on 40 acres inland, 20 acres 2 miles from the coast, with an investment of $1 million and a minimum of 25 units. The smaller resort siting to be allowed on soil classification class 4 to 8, agricultural soils, and timber sites class 4 to 7. These are actually stricter standards than the 160 acres allowed for large resorts that may be sited under the current rules. Non-resource land in Klamath County will not attract the recreational visitor because of its lack of natural amenities. It is difficult to site 160 contiguous acres on the coast or west of the Cascades without impinging on land of high crop value. Riparian and lakefront sites are developed best with smaller acreages, leaving prime resource land common in such areas intact. Wildlife overlays, large game range, often prevent large 160-acre sites from being developed, as larger resorts tend to disrupt migratory game patterns. Smaller resort size allows for resource-sensitive economic development. We have an excellent example of this in 27 acres in a fly fishing resort in Klamath County. It is sad that we are asking for this bill because it demonstrates that the exceptions process and current Goal 8 language won't allow sound small resort development. We in Klamath County hope that House Bill 3097 will help integrate regional economic strategies with Oregon's excellent comprehensive land use program. Thank you, and I'd like to refer to our proposed amendment to House Bill 3097. On page 2, we would delete lines 29 through 31 and insert apply to a destination resort on land that is predominantly SCS agricultural soils classification 4 through 8 or predominantly timber site class 4 through 7 or on land where there has been an exception to any statewide planning goal. At this time, I would like to turn our presentation over to Russ Nebon, Marion County Planner, our planning director, Klamath County Planning Director Roy Hubert, and myself represent the eastern side of the mountains. Russ will bring to you the perspective of the west side of the Cascades.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Roger, do you have amendments on your other proposals of changing of the acreages, et cetera, et cetera?
They are already in the bill, Representative Anderson, as far as I know. The 1 million threshold, for instance, that was referred to by the previous testimony, I believe, is already in the language that you have.
Russ?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, Russ Nebon, Marion County Chief Planner. I think Representative Anderson is referring to Roger's comment about 40 acres except 20 acres near the coast. That amendment would have to go in on line 32 and would be worded similar to the limitations that are currently a standard up on line 15 and 16 of page 2.
The other, I believe, change recommended was reduced to 2 million to 1 million and so on. I just, if we were serious about those things, I think we need amendments. Beyond that, I have one other question before we get into it. Been living with this an awful lot, as most of you know. But has the so-called reasons process not worked in sating of areas like this? I know it's expensive and convoluted, but has that...
Excuse me. Could you speak up a little bit?
Yes. We have a reasons process that we put in last session that in some cases allows developments to take exceptions to the goals by identifying the reasons, and that's been a very convoluted process, and generally takes a Philadelphia lawyer to get through that process. But have you tried that, and has it not worked in your
case? I think Roy can probably testify to that better than I. I'd just say generally that I'm going to approach this empirically and say we haven't been able to cite anything through it. The language, whether the language would allow it or not from a legal point of view, I assume it would, but our experience is just that it either discourages the developer or makes it very difficult to establish findings in fact when you sit where I sit on a board of county commissioners.
I think one area where we might get confused is that the destination resort statutes as we pass them and so on has got a big laundry list of things you must conform to. But if you put that aside and just ask for a siting of a resort under the reasons process, that is open and available to you, is my understanding. And some areas in the state have been successful in using that application rather than going under the whole laundry list. But
the burden of proof is still on the applicant, and I guess what I'm contending is that it would be really, to me, an advantage to the whole state, if our land use process is going to work well, to take a kind of a proactive position with a bill that would encourage the smaller resort. Because I feel very strongly, as I stated here, that that this is exactly the kind of thing that we need to make use of our natural resources and our natural amenities without impinging upon them or taking away their monetary value or extracting from the resource in any way. If not, we're going to see more and more desperate types of proposals such as we're dealing with currently in Klamath County to achieve economic development results that impinge upon our natural resources and our scenic beauty. I don't think we're taking advantage of what Oregon can market well through our planning process if we leave this as a process that where the burden is on the developer to show that the smaller resort is worthy and sensitive to the environment. I think we should be more proactive, and that's why I encourage this particular bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Parkinson.
I guess a question to Russ. He hasn't testified yet, but Russ, does this bill as drafted apply also to destination resorts in forested areas?
Yes.
I noticed that there's an exception somewhere, but I thought it was kind of agriculture. It's both zones.
Both, right.
Another question to Russ, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Parkinson.
Russ, here in the valley, it looks like the 30 miles, even if it was road miles, would preclude most any resort. I'm thinking of Bowman's. I've always enjoyed going there, but wouldn't that be within 30 road miles of an urban growth boundary? Wouldn't it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Parkinson, I forget exactly how far Bowman's is, but there are a number of them. You may recall the Elkhorn Valley Resort that we were considering around the golf course. And at the time we came to LCDC for acknowledgement, the draft of the goal said 30 road miles. And somehow, between the draft and the final adoption, it got converted to air miles. And it was surprising to us that it turned out that Elkhorn would not meet the 30 air mile standard, but it would have met the 30 road mile standard. Now, we were able to get our problem dealt with through the acknowledgement process by bringing that development into conformance with most of the goal requirements, and that satisfied LCDC because we were kind of caught in midstream. But the issue there is how many permanent residents are there going to be, and are they basically going to be commuters to an urban area? And that was the issue they were trying to address.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, Russ Nebon again. I guess I'd like to begin with a kind of a generalized comment that since the adoption of Senate Bill 100 and the concept of urban growth boundaries, there has been a kind of a latent feeling on the part of a lot of rural planners that the goals basically stack the deck against rural development. You'll recall that through the acknowledgement process, we had to fight like crazy to justify exceptions for already developed rural residential areas so that they could be put in a non-farm, non-forest zone. All our commercial and industrial zones were subject to scrutiny to see whether or not they were going to be appropriate for rural areas and whether the lands were so committed or developed that they really were not available for farm use anymore. When LCDC felt the need to address destination resorts, and the way they handled it in Goal 8, it was really the first time that LCDC recognized that there was a legitimate type of rural development that didn't need to be dragged through that cumbersome exceptions process. And the reason we're here today is because we feel it's important that the legislature and LCDC recognize that certain types of rural development are appropriate. They don't need to be treated like stepchildren and heavily scrutinized if we can review them and decide that because of the high scenic amenities and the rural characteristics of what we're talking about, and subject to protecting our good farmland and our good forest land, we can find ways to site them out there. Now, getting the goal exception does not fall under the 120-day quasi-judicial process because it involves plan amendments. So that means somebody who comes in today for a destination resort can be subjected to a 4 to 6 to 8 month process, and if there are legal challenges, it can go much longer than that. What we're talking about here
is addressing an issue that came up before LCDC when they developed Goal 8, and they sidestepped it because they weren't quite sure how to deal with small-scale resorts. And if you read the brochures and the explanations of the rule, they were really concerned about the permanent residences and the fact that they would just turn into commuting neighborhoods to major urban areas. What we've done in this bill is to basically say, if that's the concern, there's a simple way of dealing with that. And that is, let's put some standards in here for smaller resorts, 20 acres, $1 million. Leave most of the environmental controls and concerns in the bill, and then just say that as long as you don't have permanent residents, the only permanent residents are for the staff of the resort, then clearly it's not going to be a commuter kind of a situation. And that means you can locate it within 30 miles. Matter of fact, this bill even says that if you have one of the large-scale destination resorts, you can come within that 30-mile limitation as long as there's no permanent dwellings involved. It seems to us that's a very simple and direct way of eliminating the concern about these being nothing more than rural residential developments. Another thing that this bill does that's important, right now, all resorts have to be self-contained developments. That means you have to have your own package treatment facilities. There are sites along the coast and other places where there are public sewer systems nearby. And on page 2, we have an amendment that would allow those resorts to hook into those sewer systems, provided they covered all the development costs associated not only with hooking into it, but with any capacity increases that were required because of the increased loading on the facility. I think that's an important amendment that's going to make the Goal 8 process more workable. One other of the criteria that's caused some people some concern is that you can't locate a destination resort within 3 miles of farmland with a high that constitutes a high-value crop area. 3 miles is a long way. I know there are farmers who would like to have it 5 miles, but from a practical standpoint, at the local zoning level, we feel that 1 mile is more than adequate to buffer destination resorts from those high-value crop areas. And so we have an amendment in this bill that would do that. So there are 3 or 4 changes that would benefit all destination resorts. And then the major one, which is the bottom of page 2, basically says that if you're going to have nothing but visitor accommodations and no permanent residences, you can have a visitor resort as long as you have 20 acres, $1 million in your accommodations and your recreation facilities. You've got at least 25 units, meeting rooms and services for 25 people, and that you can meet those criteria. And we feel that there are enough safeguards built into the bill that it will keep from having conflicts with resource lands. And as the previous speakers have indicated, provide an added stimulus to our economic recovery. I did participate in the drafting of the bill. I'm familiar with the details of it. Rather than laboring those issues now, I'll just be available for any questions the committee might have.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Parkinson.
Russ, could you give us an example of where you have a sewer system that isn't within 30 road miles of a urban growth boundary?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Parkinson, there are southern Oregon, eastern Oregon, and coastal Oregon communities who, because of the county's ability to approve service districts, establish those kinds of systems in remote areas, and they never incorporate it, and they are called rural communities or rural service centers, depending on how they deal with it in the local plan. And some of those are in areas with high scenic amenities, and it might be appropriate to locate a facility next to those. They're not many in number, but we don't see any reason why the goal should preclude them from looking to a service system if it's available.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Parkinson.
Russ, in the future, say if one of those areas that has a sewer system would incorporate under present law, and then even if this bill were passed, would that make then that resort immediately non-conforming?
So, Chairman, Representative Parkinson, there's nothing to preclude a city from allowing visitor resorts within its own zoning regulations and within the city limits. So it would not automatically make it nonconforming.
Mr. Chairman. I think my concern, Russ, is that it would be within 30 miles, though, of an urban growth boundary. Maybe that's just when it's established, but I was wondering if it could be made non-conforming in the future, whether it could improve or upgrade or add to it.
Representative Parkinson, if that were to happen, then you would be in a situation where you could have the residences in the resort serving as residential accommodations for the people living in the city, yes. If it were a visitor resort and there were no permanent residents, that wouldn't be a problem because they've got to be rental type units.
Thank you. Is that it, gentlemen?
Yes. Did you want to say something?
I would add a few comments here real quick.
Can you give us the name for the record, please?
Roy Hubert, Klamath County Planning Director. I would say that Commissioner Hamilton, Russ Nibon have covered the bases. I would say real quickly that as far as the exceptions process go, I think all the planners in the state have essentially beat their head against the wall on that process for years and years, and our experience in Klamath County is essentially prior to 1984 when we achieved acknowledgement, and just following 1984 for complete acknowledgement. We've had a couple of projects come in where the reasons exception has been applied. It seems more complex. In fact, as I understand, it's an exception to an exception. We do have one project right now that is appealed from the DLCD to LUBA on a rural subdivision in a forested area. And that particular individual has been trying to wade through the system since 1981. It's unfortunate. We'll see what comes out of it. I'll move real quick to the intent behind smaller destination resorts. With the discussions that we've had with all the planners in the state, I think that we feel that there is really a need, and that is that a lot of people, when they go to a destination resort, try and get away from people and not try to go to a resort where there are greater numbers of people, and I think there's a real need for the smaller, more quaint, if you will, type of resort, as long as it meets reasonable planning standards, design standards, and doesn't violate basic and natural resource stakehold issues. On the issue of rural communities with sewer systems, Klamath has one, Bly, which is unincorporated, and most county planners put those under the title of rural communities, rural service centers, as Russ Nibon mentioned. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Jeff Hunter. Welcome.
My name is Jeff Hunter. I'm from Hood River, Oregon. If it can be said that I'm representing anybody, I am a member of a group called the Hood River Valley Residents Committee that's been in existence now for about 12 years. I must say, just in listening to the testimony up to this point, I've actually learned a lot more than I knew coming into this meeting. It seems that the problems that I'm going to speak to are really different than what I've heard from the southern part of the state. Large resorts versus small resorts. Our situation in Hood River that I'd like to bring forth for your consideration is what do we do with some of the best farmland in the state of Oregon, situated in a small valley, 25 miles long, 5 miles wide, surrounded by national forest, state forest lands on all sides, that has right next to it, if this bill were to pass, put a large destination resort, perhaps I think a gentleman here in favor of that resort will probably be speaking more to the size of it at this date, but the last time that we viewed the plans, we were looking at a resort capable of accommodating 1,600 people, and interestingly enough, a resort that had a mix of private ownership homes, condominiums, along with rental units available for people. So a resort of this size, existing, the land that these people own at this point, Mount Hood Meadows, borders or is within less than a mile of these prime agricultural orchards that I'm speaking of, apple and pear. And the concern that that I have is that we're going to, by allowing especially a mixed resort that could very easily have commuters in it, people living there, the drive from that location down to the city of Hood River certainly wouldn't be long, 20 miles, 25 miles, good roads, until we try to maybe put 1,700 new people on them. How could we possibly keep from destabilizing the agricultural land that exists right next to this orchard? I'm a realtor by trade, and it's interesting.
Here is not really what the planning directors wanted. They were trying to accommodate a rule of legislative council. This says that if you qualify under this language to build a resort, you don't need an exception from any goal. Well, what Goal 8 did was to say that if you met the qualifications in Goal 8, you didn't need an exception from Goal 3, agricultural lands, Goal 4, forest lands, the urbanization goal, Goal 14, or Goal 11, the facilities and services goal. It did not say you don't need an exception from any goal. Well, this language says you don't need an exception from any goal. Well, if you think about that for a minute, I don't think it makes sense, and it's not what the planning directors intended. That suggests that if you want to put a destination resort along an estuary that has been designated for some other use, or let's say it's designated for a natural use, it's a natural habitat area, you would not have to take, under this language, you would not have to take an exception from the estuary goal in order to put a resort there. I don't think that's what was contemplated by the drafters of the bill. I think what this should say, and I believe what the planning directors wanted it to say, is exactly what the Goal 8 Amendment says. If you satisfy what's in 3097, you don't need an exception from Goal 3, 4, 11, or 14. That ought to be changed somehow. We've got to get legislative council to do what we want to do and not hobble us with some of their drafting rules.
Dick, let me ask you, the sponsors of this bill have suggested an amendment on lines 29 through 31, which would say, delete 29 through 31.
On which page?
On the second page, I'm sorry. Deletes 29 to 31 says the following standards, and they will substitute apply to a destination resort on land that is predominantly Soil Conservation Service, agricultural soils classifications 4 to 8, or predominantly timber site class 4 to 7, or on land where there has been an exception to any statewide planning goal.
Well, I'd like to think that over. That has some promise. The one last comment I'd like to make about the small resorts that concerns us. The way you define what a resort is critical in terms of distinguishing a resort from something else, such as a Charbonneau. Nobody has been proposing that we open up resource lands of any quality, really, to have a bunch of Charbonneaus sprawling across the countryside. Those are not resorts. Those are places where people live and they commute to their jobs. The reason that you have the dollar limits in the Goal 8 Amendment is a way of distinguishing Charbonneaus from things that are really resorts. When you drop those dollar amounts in order to describe a class of smaller resorts, you've got to be careful that you don't invite in motels that have a swimming pool and tennis courts. If you reduce the amount of money that has to be spent on developed recreation facilities too low, and you open up lots more countryside to, quote, small resorts, what you're going to get is motels with a swimming pool and tennis court. And I don't think that's what the intent here is. Remember, we're after something that's going to give us an economic kick. We're inviting people to come in and stay at a resort and spend money. That's not necessarily what happens at motels with swimming pools and tennis courts. And why can't you have that kind of a facility, a motel, in urban areas or in rural areas that are designated for commercial use? There's some 9,600 acres of that around the state of Oregon. So that's another portion of the bill that needs a little bit more work. And it, when you think about it, that's why LCDC was extremely cautious when it did the Goal 8 amendment. That's really all I have to offer. In my written testimony, I give you a bit of the background that went into the development of the Goal 8 amendment and some of the changes also that were made in the 1983 session to make the exceptions process easier. You've heard some criticism of that process, but I would remind you that we've had resorts approved through the exceptions process, not through Goal 8, but through the exceptions process at Elkhorn, Russ Nebon was talking about, the Belts Farm in Tillamook County, the Big Creek Resort in Lane County, all of them made it through the exceptions process. So testimony that the exceptions process just won't work is not accurate.
Appreciate your testimony, Representative Anderson.
Dick, we've both been around the process too long when I start agreeing with you on some things, I guess.
Well, I think you're both getting intelligent. That's what it is. Go ahead.
Isn't it? Now, what would be the mechanism? You know, we've always wanted to address the smaller resorts. Maybe there are a few things we can do in this session, but should we give direction to LCDC or interim task forces, which don't often accomplish things like secondary resource? Have any comments on what kind of a direction we ought to take? I think there's room for giving some certainty to being able to cite some of these smaller, not city type developments. I mean, genuine, you know what I'm talking about. I mean,
well, my initial reaction to the bill was we have a land use agency, and we ought to give this job to that commission, perhaps instruct them in a bill to accommodate small resorts, perhaps give them a little direction, but not do it in this bill, because it is complicated and it's hard to work out in the legislative process. On the other hand, and perhaps it's worth pointing out that by the time the summer comes along, we're going to have a new LCDC. Through the appointments process. What I mean is new personalities on the commission. On the other hand, the legislature has from time to time taken action to make a minor amendment to the planning program, and for, as it did with the exceptions process, for example. And I think our experience with those is that if it's careful and reflective, it can be done without being terribly disruptive. I think with on the small resorts question, it may be possible to get the folks who are interested in it together to work out some of the problems that you've heard other people mention that I've mentioned, and do just that one thing in this bill. What I would oppose vigorously is an effort to undo what the Goal 8 thing did, because that is the result of long and careful crafting.
I wonder if we still have a few people that want to give testimony on this bill, but I think what we do have here is a suggestion that I believe has merit. I personally do not want to see the goal damaged either, but I think we're in that kind of as a major part of the environment. If we might have Representative Agrams, who has introduced this bill, and you, Dick, and others who are interested in it, perhaps see if we can't work out some changes to the bill that would accommodate the small destination resorts without doing damage to the system. then we can come back to the committee and see what we've got. But it seems to me we may be moving in the direction where some sort of resolution might be possible. Would that be agreeable? Okay, let's do that.
Speaking on behalf of my organization, we're willing to do that.
Fine. I appreciate that.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Parkinson.
Maybe we should have a representative from our committee.
Yes, we should. Who would like to aid?
Anderson's the best
one. And if you want to be involved with him, I think that you and Benner can keep each other honest. I don't think we've got a problem with that.
Well, of course, we need our old friend Nebob in there.
Well, that's fine. The only problem is you have too many people. You don't want it to be a committee. Otherwise, right.
Yeah, like, in all fairness, you know, I think we need somebody from the agricultural community in there, too.
Well, whatever. It sounds to me that we can maybe work this out so that we can do something with the issue. All right. Let's do that. Appreciate it very much, Dick.
Thank you.
At this point, then, I would call on Robert Hart. I think with that in mind and that understanding that we're going to have a few people sit down and work on this and come to some resolution without damaging the goal, I'd appreciate if the others that still want to give testimony, if you keep it brief, we can keep it within that framework. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Robert Hart from Josephine County. I'm their planning analyst. I almost feel embarrassed to come up and testify before this because Josephine County has the basic provisions of this bill already in place in Josephine County. We have a recreational resort bill that approves a small resort for 25 people on 20 acres. It's been worked through with Thousand Friends, with DLCD, and I think there is the basics in this House bill to make that work. I think if we can get together, then it would probably function quite well. One possible amendment, and that's only through the experience with House Bill 2758 on major resorts, is on page 5 and on page 8, where it says a destination resort is developed consistent with the requirements of any statewide planning goal. In that House bill, we changed the word develop to approve.
Right.
So I think with that change that we would fully support this, and I think that the rest of the state should have the advantages and the possibilities that Josephine County already has on board.
In your Josephine County bill, we didn't place these in 197. Is that important that we do that?
197 really doesn't make that much difference to us, whether it's in 197 or in OARs. Either one would work sufficient for us. We just needed the parts in 215, 213, and 283 to make sure that it wouldn't be in conflict with the EFU statutes.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Hart. Scott Ashcombe? Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Scott Ashcombe with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. I signed up in opposition to the bill, but there are good features to the measure. I wanted to address the problem that Farm Bureau has with the bill, and we're the people that basically wind up getting damaged by measures like this. And I wanted to explain how that occurs. Representative Anderson asked a question earlier about how the how there was a negative effect on surrounding farmland when a destination resort is sited. I wanted to explain our conception of how that might occur. That we're talking about the laws of economics. They're not statutory laws. They're sort of laws that derive from supply and demand, and the fact that there is a demand for land that's located close to desirable destination resorts. The more desirable that land is, the more demand there is for that land. As a result, the value of that land increases in accordance with the laws of economics. The farmland that is located within a 1 mile buffer of a destination resort sited on the EFU zone land, as is proposed by this bill, will experience a value increase in the value of that land. Now, for a farmer, that's bad. For a person who wants to sell his land out of farming, that's good. We represent farmers in the Oregon Farm Bureau. As the value of the land increases because it's more desirable and the demand for it increases, the assessed valuation of the land also increases, and the property taxes that go along with that are increased, so that the farmers and ranchers that own that land are are in a double bind. They're trapped. They can't sell their land out of farm use without taking the 10 times the difference penalty. I'll go into that in a minute. But they continue to pay a price in increased property tax assessment on the land because of its proximity to that destination resort and its desirability and the demand for it. That's the problem that we have with this measure. We would propose to work with you if we could on expanding
that.
The buffer. We initially proposed a 5-mile buffer. Mr. Chairman, one more problem I see with the bill that I don't think represents the intent of the drafters. On page 3, section 7 and 8, there's some dangerous wording here. What we're talking about in section 7, it reads, a county shall ensure that a destination resort is compatible with the site and adjacent land uses through the following measures. And then it does a number of things in sub 1, 2, which are statutory, and they do not now exist in the laws in Oregon. The county will by statute now, have to implement a measure which protects important natural features, including habitat of threatened or endangered species. That's not now the law of the state of Oregon. We have a federal law which protects endangered and threatened species. But here you're requiring a county to, by zoning or implementation measures, to protect them. Streams, rivers, and significant wetlands shall be retained, once again. And that's not under the domain of the county's authority at present. Riparian vegetation within 100 feet of streams, 100 feet, I stress, which is and rivers of and significant wetlands shall be retained. That goes to the Forest Practices Act, and I think that significantly expands the statutory authorities of counties in these areas. And I think there are several other matters in Section 7 and 8 of a similar nature. I ask that you study them carefully. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Appreciate it very much. Thank you. And we'd by all means like to have you involved. Thank you. Clay Simon. We have two more witnesses on this bill, then we will be closing the hearing on it and moving on to the Lifeline bill. Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Clay Simon, and I do reside in Hood River County, and my testimony today is intended to represent support for the legislation before you. You've had a number of different opinions on specific projects. I don't really believe that this is the area where those projects should be, the merits of those projects should be discussed. Personally, I believe they should primarily be discussed at the local level. One of the reasons why this issue has come up over the years is that there has not been satisfactory resolution of this issue at the state LCDC level. Without going into a lot of the history, and several people referred to it, this subject first came up in 1982, and the governor's task force recommended destinations resorts be permitted as a forest use. Later on, they they attempted to amend Gold II exception process, equally without success. And then later on, a number of other things occurred. Excuse me. I have submitted some testimony here that was reviewed by an attorney. And I don't believe I shall go into too much detail on it. I hope that it is considered. I don't know what questions
we
might
have to look at it and see if it goes into the record, sir, and ask our little group that's looking at it to make use of it.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Jim Davis?
Most of my testimony has already been covered, so I'll decline.
Thanks very much. We appreciate that. Lois Kanagi.
Um,
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lois Carnegie, representing Agriculture for Oregon, and I also will simply summarize and say that we would be supportive of the testimony of Kate McCarthy, one of the board members of Ag for Oregon. I think the Hood River illustration underlines the concern that Agriculture for Oregon has on this bill, particularly the one-mile provision on page 3. Ag for Oregon was involved in the process with LCDC in the 83 session and subsequently in working out Goal 8, and we believe that careful consideration should be given to changes, particularly in relationship to small destination resorts, and I affirm your action or your direction of appointing a subgroup to work on that, and I think the problems could be very well worked out. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it very much. Robert?
How's the strawberries?
They're coming along. Thank you.
Oh, they're delicious. They're the best in the state.
Good. Robert Cordwright.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Robert Cordwright. I'm with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Jim Ross wasn't able to be here. I'd like to, written testimony has been submitted to you. I'd just like to make a quick comment on the small resort issue. The Commission did consider siting of small resorts in writing Goal 8. I think they chose not to do that given the great variety of small resorts that can possibly be built. We didn't feel that we could come up with a definition of what that was. We've had some experience with Goal 8 over the last 3 years, and we think we can help you craft some language. I think there are two aspects of small resorts that you might want to consider in order to distinguish them from roadside motels. First is the nature of the recreational amenity that's provided. It's not just a smaller scale resort. It provides usually attractions that can only be provided in a rural area. Hot springs, a cross-country ski lodge, that type of recreational development that is really dependent on the resource in the area. Second, I think, is the orientation of the development. A roadside motel is clearly oriented to people who are traveling by on the highway. It has signs, and it's really attempting to get people to stop. Small resorts are generally located away from the road, once again oriented to a specific recreational activity or resource. We hope that you'll consider those as you draft language to deal with smaller resorts.
Appreciate it very much. Thank you for your testimony. With that, I will close the hearing on 3097. We have a small working group who will attempt to look at some of these pieces, and we appreciate their willingness to do that. At this point, we will open our hearing on two bills, House Bill 2663 and House Bill 3162, so-called Lifeline Telephone Service and Telecommunication Devices for the Deaf. We'll wait just a minute here. We'll get our list for testimony. Do you have that, Carol? Testimony, list of for testimonies?
Yes.
Okay. All right. As soon as it comes, we will start.
Take a week.
Let's start with.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, did you pick up on the first session bill on the small paper generator and the equipment and the
It's up on the second floor. Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Those of you who are here for the plastic bales, we will probably be picking those up to our hearing in about an hour.
Picking them up.
Let's start with House Bill 2663. Do we have anybody here from the Oregon Infant Telephone Association? Come on up. We originally introduced this bill at the request of the Oregon Infant Telephone Association, so why don't we have you start?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Dave Overstreet, today representing the Oregon Independent Telephone Association and GTE of the Northwest. I have prepared separate testimony, one for OITA. Actually, the testimony was prepared by Maury Astley, the Executive Vice President of the organization, who unfortunately is out of town today, unable to testify, and so I'm testifying in his stead. And then I have a few comments representing GTE of the Northwest, which is the company that I'm employed by. During the interim session, Representative Ekus chaired a committee which investigated Lifeline service. The Oregon Independent Telephone Association agreed with some of the principles discussed by the committee and offered to draft legislation for Lifeline. House Bill 2663 includes concepts that OITA believes should be included in Lifeline legislation. These concepts are as follows: affordable residential one-party service for eligible low-income customers. Eligible low-income customers mean food stamp recipients. Optional measured service, where available, will be the first choice of service, and usage may be included. The fourth concept, local access lines must be at least $15 before assistance is provided. Below this, we believe rates are affordable. Five, the program will be administered by Adult and Family Services or another state agency, not the telephone company. Six, the FCC waiver program should be utilized. Seven, costs of the program, including telephone company costs, will be recovered through the general fund. And eight, eligible subscribers must be recertified on an annual basis. We realize that not all parties working for a Lifeline bill agree with all the concepts that I've just outlined. We have worked and will continue to work on medical shutoff legislation, assistance for deaf subscribers, and a reduction of deposits and installation fees for low-income subscribers. Regarding Lifeline, there are a few areas that have been discussed that we feel are vital components of any compromise. One item is the funding aspect. Opponents of general funds for Lifeline suggest that this should be funded by a telephone surcharge. OITA members are opposed to this for two reasons. First, we currently have a 911 tax, a city franchise tax, a federal excise tax, PUC fees, and an FCC access charge. Some of these show on the bill, others do not. Some of them show on our bills and others are buried in our rate base. Second, if Lifeline is funded through telephone charges, some OITA members feel that it should be added to the long-distance carrier charges as with the current Lifeline program. Others feel that it should be added to the local monthly rate as a separate line item. All of us agree that if it eventually is added to the monthly bill, it must be shown separately. Another important component of Lifeline is that not all recipients should receive the maximum subsidy when some local rates are significantly lower than others. Portland customers pay over $15 a month, while Mount Angel customers pay less than $10 a month. We believe that $15 is affordable, and customers with rates below that should receive no subsidy or at least a reduced subsidy. We also feel that food stamp recipients and Adult and Family Services Administration of the program are vital. An alternative suggested by Representative Ekus is optional plans designed by local telephone companies and the Public Service or the Public Utilities Commission. This would be acceptable to us. We will continue to work for compromise positions on any remaining differences. However, we feel that the concepts that I have just outlined are a necessary part of any plan. Because we expect a significant rewrite of House Bill 2663, Mr. Astley has not included a section-by-section analysis of the bill with this testimony. However, if any committee member would like more details regarding any part of the bill, he'd be happy to provide the committee with that information.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Peterson.
Thank you. Dave, I don't know if you can answer this, but in the testimony, you or Maury talked about assistance for deaf subscribers, and I think it's pertinent today because these people are in the room. What sorts of things has the company worked on? Do you know?
Well, we support the concepts embodied in the TDD access bill that's before the legislature, and we believe that the TDD program can be incorporated into the Lifeline bill in one piece of legislation, and as a general rule, we support that concept.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I do have some comments I'd like to present now on behalf of General Telephone of the Northwest, if I might.
Thank you.
Okay. GTE of the Northwest supports the concept of Lifeline telephone service, and we believe that this is in keeping with the objective of providing universal telephone service. We would prefer that the service be funded by the government, just as other public assistance programs are, but we are open to various funding alternatives. One method that would be acceptable to us would be for the Social Welfare Agency to reimburse us for the rate differential between the Lifeline fee and the regular monthly charge and cover, at a minimum, federal access charges. Another option would be an excise tax on all customer access lines in the state to cover the cost of the program. Although we prefer these methods, I would want to emphasize that GTE remains open to other alternative funding ideas. In addition, GTE believes there should be a means test for those people considered for Lifeline service, such as limiting Lifeline to people who qualify for other state assistance programs, and a state social services agency should be responsible for qualifying eligible recipients. In any case, we would want assurance that language incorporated in a bill would allow us to recover any administrative costs associated with the program. When considering a Lifeline plan, it is important to clearly define its objectives so that subsidies can be properly targeted to areas of real need and expenses strictly limited to the amount necessary to achieve that objective. Lifeline telephone service should be a minimal, essential need service directed to those individuals truly in need. The service should be limited to individuals who would otherwise have a difficult time communicating without a telephone. We believe a better solution is optional local measured service. LMS, which is currently an option available to many of our Oregon customers, provides service at the lowest possible cost and permits